Hey, everybody. My name is Howard Chaykin. I drew the original adaptation of the Star Wars comic book, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, funny book fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber, broadcasting once again from the lair. Folks, when you talk about comic books, when you talk about some of the biggest names in the business, you gotta talk about my guest today. He does it all. He writes them, he pencils them, he inks them, he does it all. Some of the biggest titles of all time for DC and Marvel, a bunch of other companies, including, of course, Marvel's original comic book adaptation of Star Wars. He also launched his own titles, such as American Flag. Then he segued from page to screen, writing for television on some cool superhero series. We are going to talk about a lot of stuff today with Howard Chaykin. This is going to be a fun one. I also want to mention that Howard worked on one of my favorite comic books of all time, Marvel's The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. We are not going to talk about that comic book on today's show, but I have chatted with him about it in the past. If you are an Indiana Jones fan, and chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are an Indiana Jones fan, you're going to want to check out the interview that Keith Voss and I did with Howard Chaykin over at the IndieCast. It's episode 146 of the IndieCast. You can check it out. Stream it at theindiecast.com. I'm going to put a link to that interview up in the show notes at my website, comicbookcentral.net. You can also download that interview from the IndieCast. It's on iTunes. Subscribe to the IndieCast on iTunes. Subscribe to Comic Book Central on iTunes. You get all the episodes. It's good stuff. While you're there, leave a review on those shows if you can. Really appreciate that. A lot of Howard Chaykin to be had. Can't get us enough of Howard, can we? And hey, be sure to stay tuned after the interview today, as I'm going to be bringing you a little bit of my adventure from Marvel Universe Live. That's going to be coming up as well. That's when the Marvel characters took over the nationwide arena here in Columbus, Ohio. That is coming up later in the show. Right now, I want you to take a listen to this, and then I'm going to be right back with the Don Rickles of cartoonists, the cuddly curmudgeon of comic books, Mr. Howard Chaykin. Jersey boy Howard Chaykin, born in the Garden State, raised in Staten Island, New York, he developed a love for comic books at an early age, eventually becoming apprenticed to the great Gil Kane, co-creator of the modern-day Green Lantern and the Atom for DC and Iron Fist for Marvel Comics. Now, Chaykin's early work included his own creations, Dominic Fortune, Iron Wolf, and Cody Starbuck. In 1977, he teamed up with writer Roy Thomas for the mega Marvel Comics hit, the six-issue adaptation of the smash science fiction movie Star Wars. Now, Chaykin stayed on the book for a few more issues past the adaptation, penciling one of the coolest standalone Han Solo stories. Now, but with his past success of coming up with original works, he was itching to do his own thing. In 1983, he got the chance as artist and writer with American Flag, a commercial and critical success for First Comics. It was a sci-fi political satire mixing many of the elements near and dear to Chaykin's heart. But it wasn't just in the world of four-color adventures where Howard Chaykin found success. Starting in the 1990s, he went Hollywood, writing for such television series as The Flash, Viper, Earth Final Conflict, and Mutant X. Now, in the world of comics, my guest today, he does it all. His work includes the Marvel Comics adaptation of Star Wars, the critically acclaimed series American Flag, and updates of classic characters Buck Rogers and The Shadow. He's also written for television, including one of my favorites here in the lair, The Flash. A big welcome to comic book legend Howard Chaykin. Howard, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you for asking. How are you today?
I'm in California, which is a good thing. I'm cold, which is not necessarily a good thing. But generally speaking, I'm vertical. So there you go. Most of my teeth, some of my hair.
All still together and all still...
let's not push our luck. The day is young, you know?
Between the two, we talked about the writing. We talked about the artwork that you do in comics. Do you have a preference between the two?
No, not really. I mean, to give you an honest answer without being facetious, I became a writer of my own stuff when I realized that I was a better writer than most of the people I was collaborating with. Because in my generation, it's not true now, but in those days, most of the guys who were writers in comics, with a couple of exceptions, were failed artists. And it didn't seem to me that was enough of a credential to be participating in that relationship. I spent most of my adult life, which I trace back to my late 20s, trying to develop a vernacular voice for comics, a voice that didn't sound portentous, that felt like the way I speak. My role models in that regard, are oddly enough, in the context of writing, are mostly Frank Lesser, who was the guy who wrote Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Most Happy Fella, who I believe was the single greatest vernacular songwriter in the American popular song.
Interesting. And you're a huge jazz fan too.
Yeah, pretty much.
What was it that you weren't happy with as far as the writers? Was it character development, plotting, or just a whole combination of everything?
A couple months back, I wrote an extended exegesis about who I am and why. And in writing it, I learned something about myself that I hadn't really put on paper for years, which was in any context, which is that I'm the least talented and least naturally gifted of my generation. I got work out of being a grind and being available. And for the most part, I wasn't really technically up to the work that I got. And my skill sets when I started in comics were not appropriate for what was being done commercially. And by the time my skill sets caught up with the work, my interest in that material had sort of fled, okay? So for me, I just, for the most part, comic books are, at that point, in the early 70s, most writing in comics is pretty perfunctory. And the writing, what made the material appealing, for the most part, was the visuals of it. Comic books were the text was there to support the art. And I felt that, when I came back to comics in the early 80s, after being away in the desert doing paperbacks for a couple of years, after being driven out of the business by the then editor-in-chief in Marvel Comics, I wanted to do something in text, in the writing of the material, that required more attention than comic books had gotten before. And that's what I did with American Flag to a great extent.
Yeah, to a huge extent, too. Aside from yourself, best anchor on your artwork?
It doesn't count for me. I don't really give a shit about that. It's completely of no interest to me whatsoever.
Not one that you just looked at and went, I'm happy with that.
When I was doing comic book pencils, for the most part, I never learned how to pencil a comic book. I hate the breakdown of talent. I really do. There are guys who saved my ass, like Tony DeZuniga and Tom Palmer, because I was just working, I just really shit work. But the truth of the matter is, the idea of penciling an anchor is just bullshit. It really is. You draw. I never developed in the slightest bit of capacity of doing comic book inking, and inking is framed by quotes right there, in the Joe Sinnott way, or the Dick Giordano way, or the Wallace Wood way. What I learned to do finally was to make an asset of my liabilities, which is to take a brush, outline it, get in there and ink, and keep polishing until it turned into a drawing that could be reproduced. I loathe the idea of pencilers and inkers. It has no context in my life. When I started out in my career, when I was just doing pencils and I was inked by various people, they all made me look better than I deserved. it's not a joke, except maybe Vinnie Coletta.
Well, was it was art though your first passion, or was it writing?
Oh, I wanted to be a comic book man from the minute I started learning my comic books.
Okay. Was it the art though that drew you in?
Well, when I was a kid, I got a huge box of refrigerator sized box of comic books from two cousins of mine, and I can still bring up the sense memory, the smell of that paper. And in those days, if you read comics, you read comics, everything. You read Funny Animals, you read, romance stuff, you read teenage comics, you read horror stuff and superheroes and everything else. And I fell in love with this material from word one. And for some reason, at the age of four, I was able to discern the fact that these didn't just happen organically, that someone made them. And I wanted to be the guy who made them from word one. And I've done everything I possibly can, with an occasional sidebar offshoot here and there, to do this for a living. And it wasn't until my mid to late 20s that I realized I should be writing my own stuff as well, which means you move forward from being a comic book artist to being a cartoonist. I define cartoonist as someone who writes and draws. Well, I write and draw my own stuff. I write other people for other people, and I draw other people's work. But at heart, I'm a comics man. And for me, the fact that the writer in comics these days is the alpha dog remains a complete and utter anomaly to me. It's ridiculous. I mean, I know why it's true, but it's still ridiculous. Because what it confirms is that the enthusiast out there has little or no idea of how much of the writing of comics is actually done by the artist.
Yeah, well, that was the Marvel method, too, back in the day, too. Whenever they would get plots, I would think.
Well, that's because, frankly, Jack really ran the roost in terms of the narrative visual, and Stan was running behind him to catch up and put words to it. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those people who believe that Stan did nothing and Jack did everything. That's just nonsense. I think there was an enormous synergy that existed between Stan and Jack. I mean, to the point where when Jack left the Fantastic Four, I stopped reading it.
Mm.
You know, I stopped reading Spider-Man when Ditko left it, you know?
Yeah.
Because the material itself was so completely defined by the talent appropriate to it. You know, I mean, the companies have a vested interest in convincing the readers of the characters of the brand, and they've succeeded in doing that. But I know in my heart that the brand is the talent. It's who's doing it, not what's being done, okay?
Yeah, there was the heart.
I don't really give a shit about anybody else on the Fantastic Four except for Jack Kirby. I don't care about Spider-Man other than when it was drawn by Steve Ditko. Same is true of Doctor Strange. These are the talent defines the material.
Well, you mentioned some early influences. Let's talk about the late, great Gil Kane.
Mm-hmm.
What did he mean to you?
Gil was the first artist that I absolutely worshipped. I was 12 years old. And I was a part of a crew, a bunch of guys, and all of us were partisans of various cartoonists. You know, the cartoonists we knew, this is before the Marvel stuff came along. You know, we were partisans of Gil Kane, Joe Kubert, and Carmine Infantino. We were aware of Alex Toth, but we didn't quite get what he was doing. We all hated Mike Sikowski. That was the one thing that was a unifying idea. We never really understood how good Sikowski was, really. I'm quite serious. And I was a Gil Kane partisan. I loved his Green Lantern stuff. I loved the Atom. And I met him when I was 13 years old. I'd stolen some comic books from a friend of mine. I was selling them at a used bookstore. And I met Gil there. And he was just this mountain of a man. He was huge. He was really tall. I was a little kid. And I went to work for him when I was 19. And I learned more from spending a year watching him work than I did in all the other hands-on work I did for all the other men who influenced my career. That would include Wallace Wood, Neil Adams, Gray Morrow, and my rabbi at D.C., who was Joe Orlando.
What was the takeaway from your relationship? What do you bring with you to your artwork, to your writing skills now?
Well, Gil was terrible. Gil was an awful writer. He couldn't write worth a shit. And he tried really hard, but he never really grasped that vernacular idea that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of sad because he was a well-read guy, but he was never able to apply his knowledge as a reader to the work as a writer, okay? What I got from Gil was discipline to a great extent.
Mm.
And the idea that you can actually teach yourself to be better than you start out. Because I think to a great extent, Gil was also motivated by hunger and rage in the same way I was.
Interesting. Well, you get to put some of these skills to work on one of the biggest projects. Now, I know it's probably, I don't know if there's a love-hate relationship or just a hate-hate relationship with it, but the Star Wars comics, the Marvel adaptation, mm-hmm. we talked mm-hmm. about that. Mm-hmm. Roy Thomas was the writer.
Right.
You were looking at the adaptation, which eventually
I adapted the script. I broke the script down to the visuals.
Okay, and Roy wrote
the dialogue to my adaptation of the script.
Well, that's one of the things I was interested in. What were you working from when this came into Marvel?
The shooting script.
Okay. So you had that, like, how early before the movie actually?
About a year.
Okay. What did you think when you got this script?
I didn't think much. I mean, I thought it was just another one more science fiction movie, and I had 400 stills, and I had 17 Macquarie paintings.
Oh, wow.
And the Macquarie paintings struck me as aspirational, that they wanted, this is what they wanted it to look like. And the stills basically all looked like IKEA. They were kind of inert. My first real experience was visiting the modeling shop in Burbank when the special effects shop was there, and it was really interesting. I was there the day they were putting the finishing touches on the Darth Vader's flagship.
Okay.
And I'm an old modeler, so I was really fascinated by this. I love miniatures. I'm very curious, for example, about Charlie Kaufman's new picture, Anomalisa, which is, you know, the stop motion animation puppet movie. I drew 2.5 issues of the book before the movie came out, and I was sitting in a theater a couple of days before it opened to the public. And I watched the movie. There were maybe half a dozen other people in the theater with me. And I realized in watching the movie this was going to be a much bigger deal than I would have assumed from what I'd read in the script.
You're already 2.5 in.
Yeah.
Did that change you from 3 on?
I regret the fact. I don't think I did as good a job on that material as the material deserved.
How did that change you from 3 on then? Like, because then you went back literally to the drawing board.
I was scrambling to make a living. And I was in for a penny, in for a pound.
Okay.
I did what I could. I mean, I don't believe that the work... I mean, this work will haunt me till I die. Okay? I'm serious.
Even now, because we get the new movie
out. I actually said recently in public that I'm figuring my obit in the New York Times, I'm assuming it'll probably be a Wednesday, upper left-hand corner. We'll read Howard Chaykin dies, cartoonist fucked up Star Wars comics, you know? And, you know, it's... You know, I wrote an obit for Alex Toth some years back. Which was called The Squandered Legacy of Alex Toth. Because I believe that Alex was the greatest comic book artist of his generation, but kind of a fool when it came to choosing material to illustrate, to draw. And he identified serious material as pretentious. And I'm feeling that my legacy, I'm figuring 2 weeks of maybe good ink and then pissing on my grave for the rest of eternity.
You got a plan.
My legacy will be because, frankly, you know, millions of people saw the Star Wars stuff, and only you know a couple of thousand saw the Flag stuff.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I can't rest my reputation on the work that I'm proud of. It'll be rested on the work that I'm not particularly proud of.
And that might be being too far inside of it, though. But that might be being too far inside of it too, because I think sometimes.
No. Trust me. I know better than you. Trust me.
But look, we're all familiar with the stuff that you do. But you know, obviously, with the comic books coming to life, we do like to talk about our Star Wars. Here we got the new movie out. I was curious too. That original one sheet that came out, that was for San Diego Comic Con the year before, right? So this is when you're getting all the materials.
Right.
What? So you're at San Diego Comic Con. We've got this great one sheet. You kind of recreated it for issue number one.
Uh-huh.
What was it going for at San Diego Comic Con when you were there in '76?
I don't remember at all.
It couldn't have been more like a couple bucks.
I don't know. Who cares? I don't know.
Well, I'm interested because I'm curious as to if you knew what it was going for today.
I thought that they might have been. Maybe they were free. I don't remember.
Wow. How do you think you did on that? Because it's kind of become iconic.
It's all right. It's not very good. There are any number of guys in comics who tell you that that they wake up in the morning and Jesus speaks to them. I'm not that guy, you know. I have a reasonably realistic view of my value and my importance. I know what it is. I mean, this is not false modesty. I know what I'm good at, and I know when I'm good, and I know when I'm not. It's what it means is I don't have to remember the truth in the morning. You know what I'm saying?
Well, how about the original stories? Because you got to work a few issues on this kind of sort of crazy Han Solo adventure.
You have to understand, I'm being kind and polite here. I couldn't give a shit about this stuff. It is of no interest to me whatsoever.
I totally get that. But even going back in time to 1977, Howard
Chaykin. Didn't care then, don't care now.
Really? So the movie comes out, it blows.
I don't care about the work. I mean, look, I haven't seen the new movie. I will sooner or later.
I was going to ask you.
sometime between Valentine's Day and St. Patrick's Day when I get around to it. I'm just not that guy. I'm not the audience for this material. I mean, I had breakfast with those colleagues this morning. We were talking about the movie, okay?
Yeah.
And I said that, you know, for me, it was seeing Andrew Stanton's John Carter. That was the real big thing for me. Because John Carter, the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff, is one of the three linchpins of my career. It's why I do what I do. It's one of the reasons I do what I do. I read my first Edgar Rice Burroughs novel the day before Ayers Bar Mitzvah, October the 25th, 1963, and it changed my life. It was a transformative experience, much more so than Star Wars was. Star Wars was a job of work. And again, I don't deny or abnegate in any way your generation and those around it who still worship this material, but I don't care about it. And again, I'm being polite in letting you talk about it. It's not work that reflects the qualities of my work that give me any value. My work doesn't become what it's supposed to be until the early 1980s, after I shake off my lazy slacker nonsense of the 20s and accept the fact that everything I do is going to be on my permanent record for the rest of my life and try to seek absolution by doing American Flag, Times Square, The Shadow, Black Hawk, Black Kiss, serious work. Work with attention to detail that has quality, but unfortunately reaches nowhere near the audience that the Star Wars work does. So I will be identified with work that in no way reflects who I am, what I am, and what I should be for the rest of my life and well past my death.
Well, okay? I think fair enough. But I think some of what you did, or at least a large chunk of what you did, was the live action stuff. Writing for comics, writing for television. Differences, preferences?
Well, I learned a great deal about being a writer from working in TV, okay? My first hour of television was written for The Flash. I think it was for the second or third episode of the show. Mm-hmm. And it was the most expensive hour of television ever written, ever produced. And I learned a great deal about cutting costs. When I ended up running my own show, every time I tried to give a writer in comic books a leg up and giving them a job in television, they completely misunderstood how much of writing and television. And this may not be true today because budgets are just beyond belief. But I was working against some really tight money. And the reality is television is about servicing your existent cast and your existent sets. Not anymore, I guess. When you look at a show like Game of Thrones or, you know, these things are just, they spend money like I have no idea where that money's coming from. I was working on crappy shows that were being shown at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and then 2 a.m. on Sunday. And I was grateful for the work. But the work has no lasting value. And when I saw when I recently re-saw some of those old Flash episodes at the 25th anniversary of the show, I spent most of the time cringing because it seemed facetious and not particularly clever. I might add, I've never seen the DC TV stuff that's on right now. I've never seen Gotham or The Flash or Arrow or any of that stuff. I don't really care about that work.
Okay, that's what I was curious about, because you're credited with co-creating Harvey Bullock. We've got him in Gotham.
And I'm grateful for the money.
Yeah, I'm just curious, though, because there's such a crime element and such a, you know, visceral element to that show. I was curious if you just kind of tuned in and just to check out what's going on.
I mean, if I'm going to watch a crime show, I'm going to watch a crime show that takes place in an absurd reality as opposed to something where Batman is 11 years old waiting to become Batman.
So you're no interest in writing episodes for Gotham?
No. I don't live in Los Angeles anymore. I can't write television anymore.
I was just curious because that's one of the, you know, the first things that came
to mind. Television is a local business. You can't make a living writing freelance. No, I have no interest in it.
You've gone on record saying...
I'm aged out, babe. I mean, I got fired from my last television job when I was 51, okay?
Yeah.
And it was a show that was utter shit, and they still didn't think I was up to the job, okay?
Which one was this?
Mutant X.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask you about that because you've, I thought you've gone on record saying that you had a good that you enjoyed working on the episodes that you worked on.
No, I loved working on The Flash. The first half of my TV career was spent working for two guys I still adore, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo. The second half of my career was working at Tribune, some of the worst people I've ever dealt with.
Hmm. And this was Mutant X?
Yes. And Earth Final Conflict, the worst television show ever made.
That one I was going to stay away from. Because
oh, my
I kind
God.
Of...
I mean, this is that was like Satan, you know, just the worst.
That's why I was going to stay away from it.
Oh, it's correct.
Well, with Mutant X, before we get into the Flash, but with Mutant X, there was this whole thing, you know, with Fox coming in. This was around the time of the X-Men movies.
I got caught in a kind of a vaguely criminal kerfuffle between a bunch of people, and I never recovered from it.
This was Marvel producing it. This was Marvel Studios producing it.
I have no idea who was doing what, and it was just like I was a sucker. I was like the Lee Harvey Oswald of that experience, you know.
So did they even talk about bringing actual Marvel characters in, or were they just trying to...
No, I mean, look, it was just an on-the-fly situation. I mean, yeah. I really don't know where these people were coming from. I really don't know. When I got fired, I resented it and then was very grateful.
I mean, what reason did they give for axing you on the show?
They just didn't like what I was doing. Mm. And the fact is, it confirmed something I knew. I had to learn within the next couple of weeks, which is I no longer wanted to do this anymore. I mean, literally, the first half of my career, I had the best time. I love those guys. The second half was a nightmarish just series of experiences.
Well, let's talk about those two guys that you do like working with, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo.
Terrific guys.
Fanboys.
These are stand-up cats.
Fanboys, passionate about their comic books, passionate about their comic book characters. How did you get involved with writing The Flash?
I was in New York City pitching a miniseries to DC, which was going to be drawn by Michael Golden. We all agreed we all were going to do it, and nothing ever happened because Michael Golden just disappeared. I have no idea what happened. And I got a call from my then agent telling me that I had an episode of The Flash to write. So I was grateful. That's my first TV show. Of course, they fucked it up. They sold me down the river. They got us incredibly cheap. Because they didn't, they took a per episode fee and a weekly salary that was just insulting it. So The Flash got me very cheap. And we ended up going out there thinking we had an episode. We had a staff job. We were hired as story editors. And, you know, it was a great gig.
And this is you and John there. Francis Moore, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I have no idea where John is now. I haven't spoken to him in years.
Okay.
He's out of state somewhere.
So you come in, so you get the gig. So now you're like the writer on, and again, you're looking
and
this.
They have another writing team where they fire 2 weeks into the series, into the writing schedule. We end up writing 7 originals and rewriting 2 freelancers.
Say what you will about the series. I mean, you've got some of the standout episodes, and I want to kind of get into those.
I mean, look, the fact of the matter is the best Flash episodes were written by me and John. There's no question about it.
I agree with that. They're the standout ones.
But again, that's like saying the world's tallest midget. You know, they weren't good, but they were better than everything else.
Well, but I'm kind of looking at this because they're trying to hit a lot of different worlds. We'll talk about that. But just a tough nut to crack on some of these things. But in one interview, you mentioned the toughest character to write for was Julio, played by Alex Dazaire.
Yeah.
Why was he the toughest character to write for?
Because you didn't want to write him as a cliche, and he was there to sort of push plot along. And to explain why. And whenever we wrote him as a straight character, they tried to goofy him up. And Alex isn't a goofy guy. Alex is a pretty serious cat. Although he's a good comic actor, he finds comedy in reality as opposed to goofiness.
What did you think the first time you saw not only the sets and the production design, but John Wesley Shipp as The Flash?
Well, I see John every now and then these days. I'm in sort of occasional touch. I loved the set. I loved everything they did. You know, I think if the show had not been on CBS at that point, it would have had a good 5-year run somewhere else. The problem was, and it's hard to explain to people who are as young as you are, that in those days, CBS was a geriatric network. It was completely and totally consumed by old people. The only people who were watching CBS were over 50. And Jeff Sagansky was trying desperately to find a youthful audience to suck into CBS. And there was no place to put it. There was nothing to lead up to it. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Had it been on Fox,
with the
it
Simpsons,
would have had a good 5-year run.
with Bart Simpson, yeah, it got crazy. And we talked about with Bart Simpson. Yeah, the competition. We talked about this with John Wesley Shipp too. It was the war coverage. It was the baseball playoffs. It was bounced all over the schedule. Everything was going against you guys. But still some rock-solid episodes. One of John's favorites, I believe it's one of yours, Watching the Detectives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With Joyce Heiser.
Exactly. Going into that, how you mentioned that this was one of the most expensive episodes of television.
Yeah, we wrote – I mean, this is the one.
What did you write? Were you writing it for like a movie or something?
It was the first television episode I ever wrote. Yeah. You know?
What did you include and what did you have to take out?
Directed by the fabulous Gus Raconis, you know, who's just a wonderful guy. Who again made us look really good, and we had a great time. We wrote with a much bigger cast. You know, with Bits of Business. You know, we were writing for character, and they cut it, a lot of it, and we got down to an actual shootable level. And Joyce is a gas. I mean, I saw Joyce and John at the 25th anniversary thing, and a couple of years back, Joyce and I ended up on a panel at a convention in Detroit. And she's really funny. She's a smart, great-looking dame.
She had a great character on the show too. And you even get a name drop.
And again, you know, I mean, our original draft of the trial of the trickster stuff with the whole prank stuff was much slimier, much dirtier, and much sexier than what showed up on TV.
Okay. Well, that's why I kind of want to ask about too, because there's this whole thing where CBS is wanting more realistic. If I'm getting the right message here. CBS wanted a more realistic show. You guys wanted the comic books.
They originally wanted to have the Flash in a red tracksuit.
Okay.
Okay. The costume stuff was not working for them.
Like the $6 million man?
Pardon me?
Like the $6 million man?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you have to understand that the sensibility and mentality that exists today, you now have a group of people running the various studios and the various networks who grew up reading comic books, who grew up going to comic book movies. The guys we were working for did not come out of that world. You know, right. they did not that did not exist. You're not dealing with guys on an executive level who grew up in the 90s reading Image comics, the X-Men stuff. They read Chris and John stuff, you know, so they know this world, you know.
How difficult was it Because there's this great article that almost goes behind the scenes for like a couple weeks in one of the comics, but it's like in the back of one of the Flash comics where they're just talking to you guys and the creators of the show and everything like that, where there's this pushback between CBS and you guys, the creative team, on just even the Trickster episode about mm-hmm. how was your script, the initial script you wrote, was that rejected? And then
no,
Danny and Paul had to come in and do one, and then theirs was rejected?
No. I don't know where that's coming from, no.
Okay, because it seemed like there was
We wrote, we wrote the two Trickster episodes. They were shot pretty much as we wrote with a tweak rewrite from Bilson and DeMeo. And Bilson and DeMeo, you know, gave it a bit less threatening quality.
Okay.
You know?
It's a zany episode.
What's that?
It's a zany couple of
episodes.
Yeah,
well, but that was sort of a direction that Bilson and DeMeo took everything in. I think the zaniness doesn't age well, personally.
Okay. You know? Interesting with the character because, you know, well, how do you approach a character like that that's so identified in the comics and yet you've got to write a version for television? Trickster. Well, even Mark Hamill mentioned this in the 25th anniversary, how, like, you go and he's got, like, these spring-loaded shoes and he's got all these crazy things and then you're in the real world. And some of those maybe comic book elements
don't
translate.
That the world of the Flash was a real world. I think it still had a heightened reality. I mean, the model was the Tim Burton Batman stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything real about the world in which our stuff took place.
Did you go into the comics and look at the characters and go, I'll take that.
I grew up reading Carmine's Flash.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew the James Jesse character. I knew we weren't going to get with the flying shoes and shit like this because we weren't going to get those kind of special effects. You know? I think getting Hamill was a real coup. I think it was he was really swell. And Mark is a sport. I mean, Mark was willing to do almost anything. I mean, he hurt himself in the trial sequence. You know.
Didn't he throw his shoulder out, I heard, or something? Yeah. Or is that a true story?
Yes.
Was he like slamming up against the wall at the end of the episode or something?
No, I think he leaped out of the witness box.
A lot of the trial
banged up a little bit. You know?
Okay, so he threw himself into and talk about throwing themselves into the part. You and John Francis Moore, he's holding you hostage, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the Trickster episode.
One more confirmation of why I did not belong on camera.
Did you have any level of fun with that, or was it just painful?
Sure. I mean, actually, that was the night I first really got to know David Newman, who ended up being working with me on a couple of shows over at Tribune.
Okay.
I hired him on Mutant X. He was just great guy to hang with. He's a really wonderful guy. He was the first AD on that show, and we had a great time. It was the best experience I ever had in TV.
Yeah.
Without question. Hey, we had a great office. We were on the Warner Brothers lot, which is just a legendary experience. You know, and you have to understand that the actual shooting of the show is incredibly boring for the guy who wrote it, but the actual day-to-day experience of doing the show is a gaff.
Yeah.
It really is. You know, I mean, and Bilson and DeMeo expected us to work as hard as he could get out of us. So we worked on editing our own shows. We were there in the cutting room. We were there in casting sessions, you know.
What inspired the character Nightshade? Two standout episodes again.
Yeah, I don't really recall. I mean, I think it was just a matter of doing a period thing. And, you know, Anthony Stark as the Ghost was fantastic.
Yeah.
And Jason, working with Jason Bernard, reading the guys we read for that part, meeting Jason Bernard was one of the great moments of my life. This guy is an actor I really love. I mean, he plays a sort of a pastiche of Lester Young and Sidney Bechet. In Eastwood's picture about Charlie Parker, and he's just the greatest. He was fantastic, and Richard Berge as a Deadly Nightshade was again a total pick.
Talked about this with John Wesley Shipp, and it was almost like like everyone had to raise their game around
mm-hmm.
Jason Bernard. It was almost like he took it to that level. Did you get a sense of that?
I wasn't on set for that. I mean, we were they had us writing. I mean, you got to remember that Bilson and DeMeo at that time were doing the Rocketeer rewrites.
Right.
And the only other writer we had on the staff after they fired the other team was Gail Hickman. He was working. So we were just frantically jamming.
You're just knocking episodes out
right.
in a room
right.
somewhere.
Every freelancer we hired was a disaster. I mean, let me blunt. I mean, nobody got it. And, I mean, I ended up...
What were you reworking?
I was flying home from a convention in Philadelphia, and I rewrote an act of an episode on the plane. Went directly from the airport to the studio to drop it. In those days, there was still a writing pool. And another case, I had walking pneumonia over the holidays. And again, I had to rewrite the first act of an episode that a freelancer had picked up on. So there you go. Welcome to my world.
If unfortunately, the, you know, we talked about why the series got canceled, but if the series had been picked up for season two, there, you name drop Gorilla Grodd in one episode.
Oh, I really wanted to do Gorilla Grodd so much.
Did you write that in? You wrote that name drop in?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so what would you have done? Because it, like, we've seen him now. We know what 2015 Gorilla. Well, you don't watch Flash, but
no, I don't. I have no idea.
We've finally seen him.
I mean, I watch an enormous amount of television. I really do. Okay.
Yeah.
I just don't care about superheroes on television.
What would you have done with Gorilla Grodd? What would you have done with Gorilla Grodd?
And I think I have no idea.
Oh, so no even thought at that point? Because I thought they were talking about
not at all.
Okay.
I mean, we were flying on by the seat of our pants.
Okay. Because they had mentioned about possibly season two premiere being the
Rogues. What are they doing on the
guy.
Show now? Is it a guy in a suit?
It's all CG, and it's basically. It was an experiment on a gorilla, and then, well, when you watch the show, but the explosion happens. Right.
This is as far as it's going
to
go.
Yeah. It is pretty amazing what they've been able to do. Mm-hmm. But I was just curious, how many of the Rogues Gallery.
We were all practical.
Okay. Know? But you were planning to bring the Rogues Gallery in season two, though, right?
Well, I tried, but, you know, I mean, you have to remember, again, they were not interested in having costume characters.
Yeah.
They felt the costume on The Flash was the only leap the audience would make. We're talking about 25 to 26 years ago now.
Yeah.
A mindset that was entirely different from what exists today. I live in a small town, okay? And totally outside of the realm of the show business in any way. Very few people know what I do for a living, okay? Except obviously for close friends. They know I work at home, and I live in a beach town. I live in a surf town, all right? A couple of years back, when the first Iron Man picture was trailering, that first Iron Man movie was running the trailers, everybody was getting all worked up about it until I realized that not a single one of them had any idea it existed in another form as a comic book. Seriously. Okay?
Right.
So what it comes down to is, when we were comic book fanboys wanting to be taken seriously for our tastes, that has happened. But the obverse of that, the real problem is that what you've got now is Hollywood, is the guys used to beat us up in high school now making money off our asses. Okay?
So I guess that's one way of looking at it.
Well, it's one of the ways I'm looking at it. There are other ways.
About 10 years or so ago, were you asked to pitch a concept for a Flash, another Flash television series?
Yes, I was.
How far did that get?
Oh, that was a cluster. I mean, what happened was...
CBS or somebody else?
Pardon me?
CBS or somebody else or syndicated?
It wasn't a network. It was a studio. Mm. I don't know where the people who were running the Warner's TV at that time are now. They may still be there. I have no clue. I mean, I moved full time out of. I live in what was my weekend house right now.
Okay.
I left Los Angeles full time about 12 years ago. Okay. I don't live in Los Angeles anymore. I live about an hour and a half north of the coast.
What was your pitch?
Well, here's the deal. What they really wanted was a time travel show.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted a show comparable to the Flash on his idiot treadmill. And I didn't want to make the pitch. I was with major clients at the time. And my agent insisted that I make the pitch. And I really didn't want to do it. And so what I pitched was, I pitched the butterfly effect, basically. A guy who the Flash was constantly going back in time to try to stop his girlfriend from dying. That was the franchise of the show. And they ultimately, wait for it, gave it to a guy who had a deal with the studio, who got a pilot fee plus a six-episode fee for nothing ever being done beyond a treatment.
Oh, pay-or-play deal. Pay-or-play deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well,
so
I would like
to get some of that cash, but I knew it wasn't. I knew it was not coming down to me.
I won't ask you if you've seen the show because
they were never going to give me the job.
You've already told me you've not seen the show, but I will say they got their time travel, they got their treadmill, and they do have somebody going back to save somebody. So
okay, well, who cares?
Working on now? Let's talk about what you're working on now.
Right now, I'm working on two jobs at the same time because I'm a moron. I'm doing a mini series for Image called Midnight of the Soul, which is a tribute to film noir, which is about a very damaged World War II vet who finds out in 1950 that everything he knows about his life is a lie and he has to put it right. And I'm working on issue 3 of that right now, and I just signed off on the colors of issue 2. And I'm working on a 12-part serial for Dark Horse Presents called Sunshine Patriots, which is about two former Rough Riders under Roosevelt who end up becoming hired guns for the studios in 1912 when the mafia tries to move in on Hollywood.
Wow.
So I'm doing these insanely commercial projects.
Now, is this
lots of caves, lots of masks, lots of ray guns, lots of shit coming out of people's eyes. That's a lie. Nothing of that.
Is this where they've come to you and said, what ideas do you have? Or this is something we want to do. Can you pull this off?
No, I mean, basically, The Dark Horse Presents is a project that I was approached by Mike asking if I'd want to do something for the book. And the Midnight of the Soul stuff is something that's been in my book for 20 years. And Eric Stevenson expressed interest. We went forward.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
So I'm there. I mean, again, these are not... I mean, I'm not doing insanely commercial stuff. I just, you know, no one's coming to me to do commercial work. And I'm okay with that.
When can we expect to see these?
I don't know when Sunshine is going to start in Dark Horse Presents. But I'm probably going to do the solicitation on Midnight of the Soul sometime mid to late January.
Okay. And I would ask if we can find out about these on your Facebook or Twitter pages, but I don't think...
Nah, I don't have a Twitter page, and my Facebook... And I use Facebook so that people who knew me in high school can find me, and I can get invitations to Europe.
I do know that you're maxed out on the 5,000 friend limit.
Completely.
So you need a fan page.
Because I'm such a beloved figure.
You need a fan page for all of us who love you so you can self-loathe.
I find social media abhorrent.
But it's good for self-loathing.
But I love myself perfectly fine without the addition of the internet. Thank you very much.
It's a perfect forum for your self-loathing.
No. My feeling is sharing it with people. Okay.
It would be the anti-fan page.
Will you stop that? Just cut this out right now. Enough.
Oh, we'll look
I'm
forward to it.
Coffee and getting worked up over this.
Maybe one of these days we'll see it. Hey, look, terrific job on these episodes. I know we're kind of going back a little ways, and it's a whole different time, but. Definitely The Flash, a show ahead of its time. We love the work you're doing in the comic books. Hey, The Flash is streaming on CWC.com, so if people are wondering about what we're talking about, they can check it out. I'm sure you get a lot of cash for that too, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm squeezing money out of left and right.
Howard,
glad. The old Flash show is now streaming again?
It's streaming. It's free. It's out there. It's free. Everybody can watch it.
I don't see a fucking dime from this.
I can't control this. I can only. I'm only the messenger.
Going right back to what I said about your face being on a post office wall. It's about time you did it.
Don't kill the messenger. Don't kill the messenger.
Okay. No,
Howard,
I can live with this.
So
I've done very well financially from that work.
I'm so glad we got a chance to chat today. Thank you for all the work you've done, television, comics, everything, and thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, you're very kind. Thanks for your interest, and stay warm and dry, and have a great new year.
Okay, note to self. In the future, do not ask Howard Chaykin about Star Wars or Mutant X. Okay, there we go. Got the note down. There you have it, folks. My interview with the one and only Mr. Howard Chaykin. Never a dull moment with the man. He does keep things interesting, to say the least. And he certainly keeps me on my toes when I'm editing the show. My thanks to him for joining me today. Look, I got to say, one of my all-time favorite comics, it's nostalgia kicking in, but it's a great series of issues. That's the original Star Wars adaptation, 6 issues, but I especially love that Treasury-sized edition. You know I love me some Treasury-sized comic books. That's one of my favorites. It's awesome. Special place in my heart for those. I'm sure many of you out there feel the same as well. If you are not familiar with the series... Man, what better time to acquaint yourself with it? Star Wars is huge again. Go back and check these out. They've been reprinted a bunch of times. Be sure to check out also what happens after the Death Star blows up in that adaptation. Issues 7 and 8, I referred to it earlier. Howard Chaykin, Roy Thomas, Legends in the Biz. Check that out. Tremendous stuff. Howard is on Facebook, as I mentioned, but he is loaded for bear on the friends list. It's like an exclusive jazz club. You just can't get in. But hopefully one of these days he'll see fit to get a fan page so we can find out the latest and greatest in the world of Chaykin. Until then, if you do want a comprehensive list of everything that he has worked on in the world of comic books, check out his entry at the Comic Book Database. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. That's going to be there. You can check it out. It is quite an extensive list. Again, my thanks to Howard Chaykin for being a good sport, talking about some of these projects, and for joining me on the show today. I really appreciate it. And do not forget about that IndieCast interview. even more Chaykin goodness to be had. Go get it. All right, kids, it is time for a little Marvel Universe Live. That is the stage show, the arena production that brings over 24 Marvel characters to life in an epic adventure. Cast and crew have been touring the country since the summer of 2014. It has been a while. Back on episode 33 of Comic Book Central, I spoke with the director of the show, Shonda Sawyer. So if you haven't had a chance to check out that episode, you're going to want to go back and take a listen to that. The show, after nearly 2 years of touring, it is winding down. As of this recording, the show is in St. Louis this weekend, so you got a shot if you're in the St. Louis area to check it out. 14 more cities after this. MarvelUniverseLive.com is where you can find out about those dates. It took a while for the show to get to my neck of the woods here in Columbus, Ohio, but it did get here at the Nationwide Arena. Now, I did not get a chance to talk with the cast and crew of the show. There were multiple shows each day. They were really, really churning these things out. So no time for anything for them but rehearsals and for putting the actual show on. But the director of interactive media for Nationwide Arena, Dave Rettelberger, he was nice enough to spend a little time with me before the main event. So got a chance to talk about what it takes to bring a show of this magnitude to the Nationwide Arena and what's on the horizon. So here I present to you your backstage pass to Marvel Universe Live.
Every superhero stands apart, but for the first time ever, one mission will unite them all in a live event. See Spider-Man, Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, Hulk, and many more. Take back the ultimate source of power. The stakes have never been greater, and the experience has never been bigger. Marvel Universe Live.
I've been waiting about a year and a half for this now. When I first interviewed Shonda, I was talking about it was Christmas 2015 weekend coming in. I was like, oh, that's forever. It's here now. You've seen the show a few times, and you've already had two today. Tell me just your impressions on the show overall.
You know, it's fun. First of all, let me say that you've been waiting for the show, so have I, because we announced this show before, you know, it was even really created. And so when it was first in its infancy stages, and to watch the launch and the behind-the-scenes material and to see the other cities get to go, and we sent a crew down to Florida to see the premiere of it, and then I was able to go down to Kentucky and see it in Rupp Arena to kind of get a preview, because if we wanted people in Columbus to be able to see the show, we wanted to be able to tell them, you know, what it was about and what to expect. And then I went down last weekend and saw it at U.S. Bank Arena, took the boys down because my sons, we would be too busy this weekend with all this stuff. I'll be working at the shows. We were able to go, and I've seen it a few times. So if that tells you anything, we had a lot of fun.
How old are your kids?
I have a 13-year-old and a 7-year-old boy.
Nice. Perfect
so
ages.
They are the absolutely target material. Where my 7-year-old is too young to see some of the Marvel films because, you know, the PG-13 and mom gets a little wary. This was the perfect event for him. And this is that chance to really, for that Marvel family to come together, for people that, you know, when you're in, you know, when you're at Comic-Con here in Columbus and you see the families together, those are a lot of the same families that you're seeing here. And one of my favorite things about the show is here and being able to see it is everybody coming in costume. You're seeing so many little kids, Hulk and Captain America, and that brings a lot of the fun to it, to kind of give it its own kind of little party atmosphere.
Yeah. So now how did this come to Columbus? Because obviously this is going back, the genesis of the show was about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So how did it come to Columbus, and, you know, just what were... just in the arena themselves, what were you guys saying about it this whole time?
Sure. Well, we work with our friends at Feld on a variety of shows. So Feld is the company, for those who don't know, who does everything from Monster Jam to Disney on Ice to Ringling Brothers. And so this was a new adventure that they were heading out on. And so we work with them on a regular basis. They were very excited about having the ability to, once Disney involved themselves with Marvel, that, hey, this could come together, and they had rights to the characters. And so when that happened, I mean, obviously it's a great event. And then they wanted to bring it here Christmas week, which, you know, I think it's a great time because so many families are in town, and especially after Christmas Day, looking for something fun to do. So it just really was a great timing for the event and a nice chance for a new family event in Columbus, which we're, you know, as our company, we have Nationwide Arena and the Schottenstein Center, and we're always looking for something fun, new for families and trying to get them down here to the arenas.
So what had to go into preparing the arena itself for a show of this magnitude? Because you've got stunts, explosions, you've got a Hulk that's smashing through everything. What did you guys have to do to prep for this?
You know, we have AC/DC and Paul McCartney, you know, and so many different kinds of shows, and the ice down here for the Blue Jackets, which is actually under the floor even today as you're here for this show. But this is something of a magnitude that is different, even much different than the other Feld shows that they do. There's so much rigging, which is when you look up above and you see everything up in the sky where there's all the catwalks and lights and lasers and explosions. So there's a lot that goes into that of it. So for that, actually, that's why we sent our crew to some of the advanced shows. I went down to see how we could market it, but at the same time, our behind the scenes, our operational staff went down to go tour the backstage areas and see, you know, we're here right now standing in a little backstage area, and this is as far away as we could be from the stage, and you can see case after case after case of things that were brought in for cranes and lines and rigging supplies, and they're using every nook and cranny here in the arena to just help hold the supplies. So
most everything I'm seeing is rigging lines.
Yeah.
I mean, because Spider-Man has to swing.
Spider-Man has to swing.
Green Goblin has to fly.
Right, and that's my highlight of the show is I don't want to give it away, but
right.
Spider-Man swinging, I do enjoy that quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't want to be spoiled of it, but I mean, you've seen this a few times. Is it, I mean, we talk about bringing comic books to life on Comic Book Central all the time. In a movie, it's one thing.
Yeah.
You get editing. You've got some special effects. Sometimes it's a CG character. This, you can't hide behind anything.
No.
Everything is right there. So just from a fanboy perspective, because I'm taking it that you are, just watching this, how much of it is a comic book come to life?
Very much, you know, and some of the obscure references that are there for the grown-ups, you know, which are fun to hear. And then, you know, for the kids, you know, it's definitely, it's almost got... As a fanboy reference, a Batman 66 kind of feel to it in some points.
Okay.
If I can take you over to the DC universe,
yeah, if you can,
you know, if I'm allowed to do that, you know. But where, you know, it's that thing where you're knowingly laughing at so many of the pieces and enjoying it, and when you can see, you know, some of the things you can't see in the cinematic universe, when you see, maybe you will see it very soon, but Spider-Man fighting next to Hulk. Fighting next to Wolverine. That's a fanboy moment.
That's exactly what we were talking about, Shonda. Yeah. At the time we did the interview, Spider-Man wasn't in this. This was the only way you could see these.
Yeah.
And he's still not fighting because that's going to be a little ways away yet. So
Fantastic Four not in this, and that's probably a good thing based on the last movie. So.
We'll be nice on that. Now, without giving it away, and obviously by the time people see that, what can you tell somebody as far as like your favorite moment or something that they can look forward to seeing without giving away... specifically, like maybe your favorite character?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a moment, and you and I discussed this a little earlier, but there's a moment when the Hulk comes out. The first reveal of the Hulk.
I kind of figured it was going to be that,
And you hear just the rumble, because Bruce Banner's in it for quite a while.
Yes.
But when the Hulk comes out, there's the rumble that goes to the audience of the excitement. It's just, it's a really neat the way they do it.
They pull it off.
They do pull it off. It's fun.
I see. That's what my thing, because you can make Spider-Man swing. It'd be tough. I mean, we've seen Captain America do a vertical leap on a motorcycle, but... I wasn't sure how they could pull the Hulk off, especially transformations and things. So this is bringing, and there's like an interactive component too.
Yeah, there is where kids who obviously are able to be a part of the show, and that's one of the neat things is for them to feel like they're part of the superhero team. And so there's a interactive device that kids can buy, and I don't give them away, but at some point
we talked about on the show. It's like a wand. It's like a Tony Stark created some little
thing. It's a Marvel wristband kind of watch thing, and then when it goes off at certain points during the show, and there may be a point when our heroes are in trouble and they're calling the friends in the audience to help out. So
everybody can help save the universe.
Isn't it? It's a good feeling, right?
It's amazing. So, okay, so we're looking forward to this. 2016, what's coming up for Nationwide? I mean, you talked about the sporting events that go on here. So for some people that are outside the Columbus area, might not be familiar with it, what goes on here and why should they be here at so many things going on in 2016?
You know, Nationwide Arena is a great, nice little jewel for Central Ohio. It's the heart of the Arena District, which really makes it unique. And a lot of cities reach out to Columbus to figure out how we revitalized. This is where an old prison was. And so this was completely rebuilt. And then businesses and bars and restaurants and some big corporations all built up around it. And it's really become a neat destination. So it makes for a nice weekend. And then we have, you know, of course we have Blue Jackets games, our NHL team throughout the season, but then we have, you know, so much more throughout the year, whether it's, you know, concerts like Chicago Earth, Wind and Fire or the AC/DC show I just mentioned. To a lot of
speaking great, of Marvel music.
Speaking of that, right? And then you know, a lot of other fun you know, family types of shows, you know, like we mentioned earlier, whether it's the Monster Jam or the circus, always something fun coming to Columbus. So a lot of good stuff, and you can always find those details at nationwidearena.com.
What are you looking forward to coming up in 2016? What's the one that you're like, this is it?
You know, we had, I mentioned earlier, we had McCartney last year, which was a highlight for me. to be involved
with. Did you get to meet him?
I almost did. I almost did. There's another story for another day. But AC/DC, my son, my 13-year-old, you know, last year he got to see The Who, The Stones, and McCartney, and so that was the last big classic rock band.
That's good parenting right there.
Right?
That's good parenting right there.
And he met William Shatner at Comic-Con this year, so I said, you know, I'm the best dad ever, but it was 1968. You know, I'm the best dad ever. But, you know, had a good time at Marvel Universe Live to bring it back, too, so he's getting a little spoiled. But AC/DC is definitely high up on the list for what's coming up, too.
Okay, this is amazing. So, and give us the website again.
Nationwidearena.com.
Looking forward to that. Thanks so much.
Yeah, appreciate the time. Hope you guys enjoy the show.
Gotta say, the show was unbelievable. It was fun. I was a kid again. It was really fun. They pulled it all off. Spider-Man was amazing. He was spectacular. The Hulk was incredible. Thor was mighty. Iron Man was invincible. Everything you'd expect from Marvel, it was there. The stunts were crazy cool. I don't even know how they pulled off some of these things. It was pretty amazing. Again, as you might have heard on episode 33 of Comic Book Central, there is a battle on top of the Statue of Liberty. It was unreal. If you're near any of the cities remaining on the tour, go check it out. I'm going to post some pics I took over on the Comic Book Central Facebook page, also on Twitter. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Twitter, it's at Comic Book CTRL. You can check them out. Be sure to like the Facebook page, follow the show on Twitter. Share the episodes with your friends. You click the share button on Facebook. Hashtag share the lair. Retweet it on Twitter. Hope you enjoy the picks. Big thanks to Dave Riddleberger for that behind the scenes listen. Folks, be sure you don't miss an episode of Comic Book Central. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Again, if you're there, please leave a review. I love it when you do that. Thanks so much to the new reviews we've got coming in. If you don't use iTunes, you can still check out the show on Blueberry and Stitcher. We're on those services. And be sure to drop me a line. If you've seen Marvel Universe Live, what did you think of it? If you're a fan of Howard Chaykin, what are your favorite books that he's worked on? Got a favorite comic book themed movie or TV show? Tell me all about it. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net, or click the Signal Me tab right there on the website. And with that, I bid you farewell. But fear not, true believers, I shall return, because next week on Comic Book Central, we're going back to the 70s and getting wet with the man from Atlantis. That's right, Patrick Duffy, the star of the NBC sci-fi series. He's going to be here in the lair to talk about super swimming and battling nefarious villains, all while wearing little yellow trunks. That's what's headed your way next time. Until then, have an amazing week. Keep reading those comics, especially Howard's. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
I'll let you know when you're boring the shit out of me and I got to split.
Oh, okay? That's going to be like in 2 minutes.
No. Again, I mean, I'm easily entertained. Trust me.
That's cool. Okay.
I'm a cheap day. Go ahead. Start up, Allie.